in more detail. So trying to put some of the things that we did in the previous lectures together and see how, out of all these ingredients, a cyclic picture can emerge. In the first lecture, I think I gave you a very brief overview of this, so today we're going to look at this in much more detail. So we can start with the single field case. So even though we saw that if you just have an ekprotic phase for a single field, typically the spectrum of curvature perturbation is blue, there can be effects close to the Big Crunch, Big Bang transition, which actually transfer a scale invariant spectrum of the scalar field into the curvature perturbation. This can only happen via higher dimensional effects, or this is not something that happens in ordinary four-dimensional field theory. So this is still rather speculative, but for the sake of the argument, we'll just assume that this can work, right? And then explore the consequences of just looking at this single field cyclic picture. And then in the second part of the lecture, we'll see what happens if we use this entropic mechanism for producing the density perturbations. In this case, also the sort of the whole global cyclic picture changes somewhat. The potential is given by a very shallow positive maximum here, then it goes down to a minimum and comes up to zero at as phi goes to minus infinity. So in the colliding brains picture, the distance between the brains would correspond to e to the phi. Now, in this case, we have the ekparotic phase here along the very steep part of the potential. So here, the equation of state W would be much greater than 1. This is followed by, as the potential becomes unimportant, followed by the kinetic phase. W is equal to 1, approximately. As the field rolls off to minus infinity, this corresponds to the Big Bang. At this stage, the universe becomes filled with radiation and matter again. The field rolls back up onto this plateau here. So at the Big Bang, also the scalar field, if you produce more matter on the negative tension brain, you sort of lower the total inertia, and you produce a bit of extra kinetic energy, which brings you all the way up onto this slightly positive plateau. And so the value here is V0, the scale of the current cosmological constant. And due to the Hubble damping, due to when the radiation starts becoming important, this field gets Hubble damped, and the evolution, so this stops the field at some value. It's not very important what particular value this is. And then we get the phases of radiation domination, followed by matter domination, W equals 0. And then as the field starts rolling slowly back, we have the dark energy phase with W close to minus 1. So from the higher dimensional point of view, this would be just the force between two brains, drawing them in together. After the Big Bang, the brains quickly separate again and become almost fixed, for the whole time when you have radiation and matter domination, and almost fixed when you have the dark energy phase. In fact, this is important because usually in this sort of high dimensional brain picture, the what we call constants of nature are typically fixed by Well, they depend on things like the distance between the brains. Now, since we haven't observed any changes over time in the constants of nature, we know that if such a picture is true, then the brains must be at a fixed position for almost the whole, for almost the whole time since the Big Bang. The only time when significant changes can happen is close to the Big Bang. So this is actually a very, well, and then the whole cycle. So we would be here now. We're just entering the dark energy phase, and then the whole cycle starts again. So this is a very sort of a minimal picture. I mean, there's very few ingredients, in a sense, to try and have a complete cosmology. But of course, the main question is, you know, is it an agreement of observations? Now, we can go through these phases and just see in more detail how, for example, the scale factor and the Hubble parameter evolve. So if we start with where we are today, so at the start of the dark energy phase, during this time, the Hubble parameter is roughly constant, and the scale factor grows exponentially, e to the ht. And in fact, we can call the total growth, right, so A, say, dark energy, and over A, dark energy, beginning, we just define this as being e to the n sub dark energy. Right, so n dE would be the number of e-folds of dark energy expansion. And we don't know how much that should be. Right? If you were to know the precise details here of the potential of the amount of matter, radiation, and so on, you could calculate precisely how much this would be, but at the moment this is sort of a free parameter. Now, so then the dark energy actually starts decaying. So the potential starts becoming negative. And if the potential becomes negative, you can see this actually is one requirement for getting the universe to revert from expansion to contraction. Right? So if you have, for example, in the Friedmann equation, if we want to go from expansion to contraction, at some point the scale factor has to stop, right? Stop growing. So A dot has to be zero at some point, which means that H is zero. So at some point, H is zero, but half phi dot squared is always positive. So we see that we need V negative in order to get the universe to start contracting again. And this is what happens here. So. At this point, we enter the ekphorotic phase. So during this phase, we now have that the scale factor is roughly constant. But now the Hubble parameter h grows by a huge amount. So we saw earlier that h goes as 1 over t, t goes to 0, so h grows by a big amount. So h actually grows by a factor. Well, we can relate this to the potential, since h goes as 1 over t, and the potential goes as 1 over t squared. We can relate this to the potential, and this is given by the minimum value of the potential divided by the value at the beginning of the ekphorotic phase to the power 1/2. Okay, and I should really write mod h because h is negative. So then for the kinetic phase, in fact, there's sort of there's more than one kinetic phase in a sense, because there's a kinetic phase going just before the big crunch, going to the left, but then coming back from the big bang, the kinetic phase actually continues until the field gets stabilized on the right. This is because the field has a slight excess of kinetic energy, so this is still dominant over the potential, and so we can treat this whole evolution, roughly speaking, from when the field is here, all the way to it goes to minus infinity, comes back up to here, we can treat this whole thing as a kinetic phase. So to estimate just roughly how these quantities evolve, it's useful to define the temperature of the radiation as the kinetic phase comes to an end. Right, so there's, since radiation is produced at the Big Bang, there will be then afterwards some time at which there's the energy density in radiation will be equal to the energy density in the kinetic energy density of the scalar field, right? So there will be a transition time, and we just call this temperature at that transition time T sub R. So this is sort of the equivalent of the reheating temperature. This is what in inflation would correspond to the reheating temperature. Here, this corresponds to the temperature at scalar kinetic energy radiation equality. So during the kinetic phase, we saw that in one of the exercises that the energy density is proportional to 8 to the minus 6. So we know that the scale factor at the end of the kinetic phase compared to the beginning of the kinetic phase will be proportional to roughly the the 1/6 power of the evolution of the energy densities.
Right. What
value W? W is approximately 1 during this time. So in fact, A goes like T to the 1/3, rho goes as 1 over T squared. Where?
Oh, I'm sorry, this is kinetic energy.
So we know that at the beginning of the kinetic energy phase, the energy density is, this is when the field is just at the bottom of the potential. So as an order of magnitude, the energy density is roughly given at that time by the Vmin. And at the end of the kinetic phase, by definition, it will be this temperature. So it goes, the energy density goes as TR to the 4th. So if we define, it's customary to define this parameter, gamma, which is given by the log of Vmin to the 1/4 over TR. Okay, and then we can just see by plugging this in that scale factor A grows by e to the 2/3 gamma. At the same time, so H gives us 1 over T, so this is proportional to A to the minus 3, and so H actually evolves by e to the minus 2 gamma. We then enter the standard phases of radiation domination and matter domination, which we can just treat as, we can actually treat this as roughly speaking a single phase of radiation domination. There's very little difference by including the matter, since we're just interested in rough numbers here. So during this time, we know that the scale factor is proportional to 1 over the temperature, and so we know that the scale factor grows by the ratio of temperatures, so TR over T naught. But T naught is the temperature of the CMB today, temperature of the universe today. And in fact, this we can define as being given by e to the n sub rad for radiation. So it will just depend on how high the temperature was after the Big Bang, by how many e-folds of expansion we get. So we know that during radiation domination, A goes as T to the 1/2, H is 1 over 2T, so this is proportional to A to the minus 2, and so actually H shrinks by a factor of e to the minus 2 and rad. Okay. So now we've gone through the whole cycle, so we can put it all together to get an idea. Yes.
Energy space that spans about,
right, this is just, yeah, the rough. So net growth during this whole phase, yeah. Okay, so we can look at the net evolution. The scale factor A so it grows by and the e-folds of dark energy evolution, then it's constant during the ekpyrotic phase, roughly speaking. Then it grows by this factor 2/3 gamma during the kinetic phase, and finally by n sub rad during the radiation and matter phases. So typically, this is a huge number. We'll put in some typical values in a minute, but I mean, the main thing is this, so the scale factor over the course of one cycle grows really by a vast amount. So each cycle, the universe becomes, a given patch of the universe that you follow through one cycle becomes vastly bigger. So for the Hubble parameter, this evolves by, so let's say H, call it H1 over H0. If we're today 0, H, say H1 is the next cycle. So this is constant during the dark energy phase. Then during the ekpyrotic phase, it grows by a large number, e to the n ekpyrotic. So in the kinetic phase, we get a factor of contribution of minus 2 gamma. And then during the radiation phase, minus 2 n rad. So this is equal to, well, by definition, the first factor is equal to V min over the V over the potential at the beginning of the ekpyrotic phase to the power 1/2. The second one is equal to Tr squared over V min to the power 1/2. Okay, and the last factor is given by T naught squared over Tr squared. So some of these factors immediately cancel. So this is equal to T naught squared over V ekpyrotic beginning to the 1/2. But the potential at the beginning of the ekpyrotic phase is the potential now, right? So it's the scale of the cosmological constant. And this is equal to roughly T naught to the 4th. So this is actually equal to 1. Right, so over the course of one cycle, the Hubble parameter goes back to its original value. So even though the scale factor keeps growing, the Hubble parameter actually has a real cyclic behavior. So at the same time, from this, the first line, we immediately get the relationship of, well, we find out how long the ekpyrotic phase should last. And we just find that it's given by 2 gamma E plus N rad. And note that this gives no, the number of efforts of dark energy domination doesn't enter at all. And so this is a completely free parameter. So a typical thing here in the cyclic universe is that local quantities are exactly cyclic, but the whole evolution isn't cyclic as such, because, for example, the scale factor grows by a huge amount. But if you look at the universe, the next cycle, it will look the same as the cycle before, because you cannot measure this whole expansion, because this is far outside of your horizon. So if we put in some typical values just to get an idea for what these numbers mean. So typical values would be, well, we know that T naught is equal to 10 to the minus 3 EV. So we can take the minimum of the potential to be given by something like, say, 10 to the minus 3 Planck energies to the 4th, or this is also 10 to the 15 GeV to the 4th. Take the temperature after the Big Bang to be given by, say, 10 to the minus 6 Planck. So this would be about 10 to the 12 GeV. There's quite a lot of freedom in what this temperature can be, but it should certainly be below the grand unified scale so that we don't form topological defects, and it should be above 1 MeV so that nucleosynthesis works out, but that leaves a huge range. There's a couple of other constraints which make this range a bit smaller. So there's constraints that the primordial gravitational waves that you generate don't mess up nuclear synthesis. So gravitational waves have absolutely nothing on large scales now. They have no effect, but at very early times, they could still have had an effect when everything was much smaller. And there's a constraint. So this slightly lowers the maximum temperature allowed. But it's not. So the rough range that's allowed is between, say, on the order of MeV up to the order of the Grand Unified Scale. So with these numbers, you can just plug them in, and you find that gamma is given by about 7, and rad about 55, and this gives an ekparotic of about 124. So since the Big Bang, we would have had about 62 e-folds of, well, this is including the kinetic phase, about 62 e-folds, just since after the Big Bang, since the start of radiation domination, we had 55 e-folds of expansion. Now, for example, if we assume that there's no dark energy, or very, very little, then this implies that the scale factor grows by, you plug the numbers in, by about e to the 60 or so per cycle, or 10 to the 26 per cycle. So this is a huge growth. Now, the current size of the universe, the current size of the observable universe, is about 10 to the 26 meters in diameter, say, in linear scale. So this means that actually one cycle ago, our entire universe was contained in a volume of the size of about 1 cubic meter. So that's just to give you an idea of how much the universe expands each cycle. In other words, each volume of about 1 cubic meter, even if there's no dark energy, will already make a universe as big as ours in the next cycle. If you have dark energy on top of this, it'll be even smaller.
Pretty fast, so this will be like in the third cycle?
Well, that doesn't really matter because this is the whole, you know, the brains are typically infinite. The whole universe can be infinite. It just grows or shrinks by this huge amount. In the same way that, for example, in the standard evolution, if you take scales now, which are extremely small, say something smaller than the nuclear scale, but something still which we regard as, you know, observation accessible, and you trace it back to in time very close to the Big Bang, then that was, you know, sub-Planck scale. But that doesn't...
The sub-Planck scale of the previous cycle. It's what, sir? I mean, like 3 cycles ago, our universe was under the Planck scale.
Yes.
So we're probing sub-Planck...
Well, not really, because we don't know. That doesn't seem to be the way it works. I mean, that's what I'm saying. Is even very small scales now were at the beginning of, you know, this current cycle. Even if you take the standard Big Bang model, very small scales now were sub-Planckian at early times of the universe. But still, when we look at the nucleus, we're not probing sub-Planckian physics. As far as we know, there's no memory, in a sense, when the universe expands, of what happened. I mean, this is an open question, in a sense. But from what we know now, there is no... In GR, there's certainly no memory. I think this is something nobody knows, for sure. Right, so now we can see how, in the first lecture, I said that I showed you this oscillating model, which was a sort of a first attempt at making a cyclic universe. But this had all kinds of problems. So now we can see how this model actually relates all these problems. Right, so
here, for example, the matter density can easily be less than the critical matter density. In the oscillating model, you needed the matter density to be bigger than the critical density so that the universe would recollapse. Well, here the fact that it's the potential of the scalar field that goes negative, this causes the universe to recollapse. It has nothing to do with the matter density. So there's no problem in having a matter density that's less than critical. There's no... At the same time, the potential is the dark energy. So in the other model, there was no dark energy. Here, the potential at the same time plays the role of dark energy. Now, the ekpyrotic phase makes the universe very flat. And this avoids having this sort of chaotic mixmaster collapse. In the oscillating model, there was nothing to prevent anisotropies from growing as you went very close to the big crunch. So you'd have a big crunch that would be very chaotic and be very difficult to argue that there's anything sensible coming out of it. Here, the ekpyrotic phase makes the universe so flat and suppresses anisotropies to such an extent that the chaotic mixmaster is avoided. Also, there's no problem with the, since we have dark energy, there's no problem with the age of the universe, that the age of the universe, in the oscillating model, the age of the universe comes out as too short. That's because, in a sense, because you don't have dark energy. Here, there is dark energy, so there is no problem with that. And finally, there is no entropy problem, because the entropy gets diluted by this huge amount each cycle. Since the scale factor grows by a huge amount, the entropy gets diluted. So even though the total entropy keeps increasing, at each, you also increase the total volume. So the entropy density actually goes back to its initial value, and that's all that's needed. And there's one final point, which is that this behavior is stable here. So the single field cyclic model is an attractor. If you, for example, overshoot, if you have the potential and after the Big Bang, if after the Big Bang you go a bit too far, well, that doesn't really matter. The dark energy phase just lasts a bit longer, and then you go back to the normal evolution. If you don't go quite as far, well, the dark energy phase is a bit shorter. It makes no difference. So in a sense, the dark energy here stabilizes these cycles. If you have small variations away from this it doesn't matter, it goes back, you go back to the standard cyclic evolution. So you don't actually have an instability in this model. So the main problem with this really is that it's not clear whether you can get the right density perturbations. It might be possible, but this is not something very well understood. Okay, so let's look at the two-field case, where we know that we can get the right density perturbations. However, there's a whole different problem there, because we also know that the potential is unstable. Okay, so two fields and the Phoenix universe. So if we have two fields, we know that the entropy perturbation grows as 1 over T. So in a sense, this is a direct indication for what the instability is. We have this potential, which I'll try one more time to draw it. But so we have two exponential potentials. And then along the middle, there is sort of a ridge going down. And we want to follow this trajectory along this ridge. But the entropy perturbation is a perturbation transverse to the ridge. And if you're not exactly on the ridge, well, you're just going to fall off on one or the other side. So the question is, how close to the ridge do we have to be? Well, we're still at the end of the ekpyrotic phase. We still want to be going in the direction along the ridge, right, and not away from it. So we want that. What we want is that at at the end of the ekpyrotic phase, we want delta s dot squared to be much less than sigma dot squared. Right, sigma dot squared is the velocity in the direction of the ridge. And you can check with the scaling solution. This translates directly into delta S at T ekpyrotic. And being less than about 1 over epsilon. And this means that at the beginning of the ekpyrotic phase, if we go back, we know that delta S goes as 1 over T. This means that delta S at T ekpyrotic beginning must be less than about 1 over epsilon e to the minus n ekpyrotic. So this is a tiny range. But we need extremely precise initial conditions to stay on that ridge. Yes.
And you don't produce the right perturbations.
No perturbations to produce.
You need this tachyonic part of the potential in order to produce a scalar invariant spectrum. You can try it. In fact, the instability is necessary in a sense to really generate big perturbations. So we need the instability, but at the same time, it looks like it makes a cyclic evolution completely impossible. Because it looks like even if you manage to do this once, well, during the next cycle, you're, of course, very likely not to come back to exactly this starting point, and so you will certainly fall off. That's what it looks like at first. Right, so it turns out that if you take this evolution that I drew several times before. This is in scalar field space, phi 1, phi 2. If we start with the given, and the ekpyrotic phase would be here,
kinetic phase here. Okay. If you take an initial range, small field range, an initial range delta S, right, during the ekpyrotic phase, this spreads vastly by this huge factor, e to the n ekpyrotic. It turns out that afterwards it stays roughly the way it was, right? So, and also, again, if you go back after the Big Bang, you stay roughly speaking how, you know, it stays the same thing. So the total, if you have an initial field range delta S, it means the final range is roughly e to the n ekpyrotic delta S. There's no further significant instability afterwards. It's all in the during the ekpyrotic phase. So what happens if we are outside of this initial range? Well, then actually you don't flatten the ekpyrotic phase doesn't really proceed normally, so you don't flatten the universe enough. And you get, again, this kind of chaotic mixmaster collapse. And the consequence of this is that presumably you will just end up with black holes. Like, you just form a very high curvature region. It might do some weird thing for a while, but it will most likely will just end up in black holes. And of course, there's no cycling here, right? Cycling stops. However, what we haven't really done is to follow this through in detail. So we've just, this is the first impression, let's say. We should really follow what happens to this initial very small range in more detail, right? So let's say follow delta S over a course of one, say, cycle. So say we have this spread in values, delta S, over a region of size, linear size L. Okay, so the gradient, in a sense, the gradient in the field value is delta S over L. Now, over the course of one cycle, delta S goes to e to the n ekpyrotic delta S, and L, which is so, grows also by, well, grows by a huge amount. L goes to L times this factor e to the n dark energy plus 2/3 gamma plus n rad. Okay, so the final gradient is actually given by delta S over L. And then these numbers, n ekpyrotic, gamma, and n rad, we know what they are, right? Because we had these relationships earlier. We know what they have to be. So this is roughly equal to e to the 60 minus NDE. What we don't know is how long the dark energy phase lasts. Well, so this is interesting, because this means that if there's sufficient dark energy, this gradient can actually be smaller than one cycle earlier. And if the gradient is smaller, that means that there's a bigger region which has the same spread of field values. So this means that even though we started with a tiny region which had the right initial condition, but even though this region itself gets blown up, and so in this final region, one cycle afterwards, there will again be a region which has the right initial conditions. And so if NDE is bigger than 60, that final region will be larger than the initial region we started with. So we get a larger region with the right initial conditions. So NDE bigger than 60, that corresponds to, at the current rate is about that one e-fold of dark energy expansion happens in about 10 billion years, right? So the rough the time scale of the time since the last Big Bang. So this means that this translates into the fact that we need the dark energy phase should last bigger, more than about 600 billion years. 60 times that. And as far as we know, there's nothing wrong with that. There's no observation that would contradict this. We know that W is very close to minus 1 now, and there's no observable deviation so far. So if the dark energy phase lasts long enough, even though we have this instability in the potential, we keep making regions that are have the right conditions to be habitable. So regions that are flat and that have the right kind of spectrum of density perturbations. Yes.
Solution is an attractor.
That was a single field solution.
Single field. What about this one?
This is most definitely not an attractor.
Well,
this is completely. This is unstable.
Interesting. So what's that in dark energy? Before you said it didn't matter. It was stabilized by the dark energy, and it didn't matter how far
it
went.
That's because there was a single direction.
Right. Well, now it seems like it does matter how far it goes after the balance, right?
Well, yeah, and mainly it matters whether it goes slightly off to one side.
No.
Yeah, it matters hugely. So the point is that you start with a very small region here, up here. Now, when you come up, then you have the full evolution, but this gets blown up. This is unstable, so many of these trajectories will just fall off. I mean, these trajectories will just completely spread out over this potential. Only those that stay very close to the ridge actually make it through the big crunch and will again re-emerge as an expanding universe. All the others will collapse into black holes. Right? So this is all black hole. This is something like our universe. And all the rest is again black hole. But the point is that the region which comes back is a tiny fraction of this whole region, but everything gets blown up, it grows by this huge amount. So that in the end, you have a region again which is bigger than our current universe, with again the right conditions to keep going. So this leads to if we look at the global structure of this, then we'll have huge regions of the universe, right, that are habitable. In between, there's regions that have collapsed.
and have stopped growing, stopped cycling.
But then, most of this region will also collapse during the next cycle. But there's a tiny region in here. This is habitable, this is habitable. But this will, all this region will collapse during the next cycle. And then this tiny region will grow into becoming, making a region even bigger than this whole region during the next cycle. And out of that region, again, a small region, but which will again, which will be bigger than this one, will grow into making something even bigger. But at each, if you take a snapshot at each, during each cycle, it will always have this kind of global structure. Vast creatures are habitable, but most won't make it, and some that will. Now, let me just make some comments about this. So this means that most likely where we are now, we won't be able to make it through one more cycle. Because most likely, what the region that will make it, since it needs these very special initial conditions, this will most likely occur somewhere in empty space. Anything you do to a region, but us just being here, we perturb it so much that probably that this, you know, means that this region won't make it. The region which will make it is extremely tiny, so it's much less than 1 cubic meter in size, a region that will make something as big as our universe. So if you don't have to perturb it by very much so that it won't make, so that it will collapse. So at the same time, this means that you can ask the question, since we have a cyclic universe, there were cycles before, there must have been, since we're here now, there must have been civilizations in the cycle before and in many cycles before. Of course, they had a lot of time. They had at least 600 billion years, maybe trillions of years. So they could have been extremely advanced. Much more advanced than we are now. So why don't we have a message from them somewhere? Well, we can't, because anything they try to leave us as a message will cause that region to collapse. Anything you do, it will automatically make it, shrink away into where we, you know, turn into a black hole at the next crunch. So that means that actually, classically, we're completely sort of cut off from the cycle before. The only thing that remains from the cycle before are the quantum perturbations that are generated during the ecbotic phase that turn into the temperature fluctuations in the CMB. And then again, you can see that dark energy plays a very essential role here. So dark energy is what stabilizes this whole picture. If there wasn't any dark energy after a few cycles, this whole thing would completely collapse. Right, so dark energy plays a completely crucial role. And so what I said, in the first lecture, the two big, really big unsolved puzzles are the Big Bang and dark energy. And this is one attempt at, you know, making a cosmological model that incorporates both of these ingredients in a very essential manner. Of course, whether this has anything to do with reality will ultimately depend on observations. And so the most important thing to work out at the moment is to try and find observational probes such as non-Gaussianity, you know, gravitational waves, and maybe there's other things that no one has thought of yet that could test this. I think so. I'm going to end here. Thanks.
So what happens to these collapsed regions? Do they evaporate or something like black holes?
Well, they're huge, big black holes. They take an extremely long time.
Like 600 billion years, or how long would that take?
Well, it depends on how big they are.
Yeah. But it's not a problem,
No, I mean, because compared to the size of all the rest, this is the other regions keep growing hugely. So the fraction of the volume of space-time that will be in those dipole regions is extremely tiny.
Right.
And they're completely uninhabitable.
Yes.
But the point is that they're not, that doesn't matter. Right, you see, if there's any, so at the same time, this is stable in a way that's very different from, for example, say, eternal inflation. Because in eternal inflation, if you have a quantum perturbation, a big quantum perturbation, it makes a whole new de Sitter phase, right, which grows hugely and which is uninhabitable, but it becomes huge. Here, if you have a perturbation, in a sense, it makes the region that collapses and drains away. So you don't have to worry about big perturbations, because they just become unimportant.
So how do you know you're not going to undershoot? Because here, in the old cycle, it didn't matter. You just kept doing the same thing over and over. Sometimes you undershot it, sometimes you overshot it. Here, you always have to overshoot, or you have to consistently overshoot, or your whole universe collapses. How do you know you don't do that?
Well, if you undershoot once, it's not necessarily a problem. You have to overshoot on average. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you undershoot a bit, that means that the next cycle will be a bit smaller than the one before. But you certainly need, you know, a significant amount of dark energy. That's a requirement in this picture.
You talked about making assumptions that the perturbations are unchanged during the actual bounce. How well is that physics understood? Is that taken as an assumption, or do you find that to be true? Are there any?
Well, it's ultimately an assumption so far. It's there are. You can make a sort of classical or semi-classical calculations of what happens at the bounce, and for example, also to see what kind of particle production you have, and so, and you find that everything is finite and it all works. Ultimately, you would like the full quantum treatment. So this, at present, is clearly an assumption. The main argument for it on the classical level is causality, because the modes you're interested in are much bigger than the horizon around the time of the big crunch. Yeah. And so you would assume that what happens doesn't change the, what happens on scales much bigger than the horizon. But this is not fully understood, because in order to understand this fully, you would need a more complete theory of quantum gravity, I guess.
So it seems like you need the dark energy takes the sense of the gradient. So wouldn't you expect that now, at time before, dark energy has sense of this, we would see a dark gradient?
So right now, we would have, so delta V over V would be about V comma S delta S squared over V. This is roughly epsilon delta S squared, if you look at the form of the potential. And we know that delta S has to be less than about 1 over epsilon. So this has to be less than about 1 over epsilon. And that's only if you're in a very early cycle. Right, so this is the most you can have. That's about 10 to the minus 2. Current limits, experimental limits on this are about 10 to the minus 4, 10 to the minus 5. But the point is that if you go one cycle further, then everything is being stretched out much more. And so this will be much less. But in principle, you're right. There is a spatial gradient in dark energy. And in fact, you could even use this as a cosmic clock that goes from cycle to cycle. Because in each cycle, this spatial gradient has to become smaller, automatically becomes smaller and smaller. So actually, this is the quantity that evolves over extreme time scales. This is something new in this model also. So we're now, usually we're accustomed to having quantities evolve over at most something like 10 billion years. Here you can have quantities like, for example, this, which evolve over trillions of years. So this can give you completely new mechanisms for addressing certain fine-tuning problems, for example. But this is something that hasn't been explored yet, really, so this is definitely something worth looking at.
How natural is it to have this kind of potential from a higher dimension of energy?
Well, it's
So in this colliding brains picture, you can have forces due to virtual membrane stretching between the brains. And this typically gives you something of this form.
Very flat part.
Oh, well, right. So this is not, that's not really enough. If you can then, how natural it is to get this flat part. But it might be that actually you don't start out with the flat part being so shallow. You can have, this might be another quantity because that can evolve over much longer time scales. So you could have a model where for example, you start out with a dark energy phase that's very, where dark energy is a very high energy state, and then it's just, you know, slowly comes down to smaller and smaller values. Actually, if you make a model like this, it turns out that you spend more and more time, the tunneling becomes slower and slower as you go to lower values. And so actually you spend more and more time at lower values, which makes it more likely to be in a where the value is smaller. Again, this is something that's really an open problem. There are ideas for how this can work, but this is, you have to remember that this whole subject is a very, is kind of a young subject. So there's still lots of things to be done. There are lots of ideas for how things work out roughly, but at some points there are clearly more detailed calculations are needed.
So when you're tunneling for smaller values, the dark energy, is that happening over many cycles? Or?
In that, yeah, it would. Yeah. So you spend many cycles at one value and then another one.
You go from one value to some other value with lower dark energy.
For example, this is an idea just of how this could work. I didn't present it in lectures because it's not something that can be considered well established. I mean, it's one possibility.
Does this not explain why the dark energy that we observe today is such a tiny number? Like, it still is based on the fact that the wave existed and.
Well, this is what I just said. There are ideas for how you can start with a high value and then slowly get to a low value. There's no intrinsic explanation here for why it has to be the exact value it is today. The model can work with very, very different values of the dark energy. Of course, we know that if the dark energy value is too high, you don't form galaxies. So you could have a cycle, but it won't form galaxies. There will be no life in it. So there could have been lots of cycles which didn't form galaxies, but then as the dark energy value became lower and lower, suddenly you start forming galaxies.
Can you explain why it's necessary that it's going to become lower and lower? Or the dark
I'm talking about a specific model, like where you have a potential, where you would have a potential for the curve, for the plateau, for the value of the plateau, mm-hmm. which was just slowly decaying.
So it's at the beginning of this drop place that it's rolling down this potential, and at some point.
No, this would be a different direction than what I've drawn so far. This would be a potential just for the plateau. This is not. You would have to go one dimension higher to draw it. Okay. That's just an idea. I mean, it's not an essential part of the model.
I have a scientific fiction question. So you said that if the intelligence a cycle before us has evolved 600 billion years, and I'm just interested, is leaving a message, this action will cause their region to collapse, or it's just their region is just more likely to collapse?
Well, this is not something that I've done any detailed calculations about. I'm just saying the initial condition has to be so precise that in a very small region of space. So that if you try and do something, you know, wherever there is something in the region of space like that will already automatically cause this field gradient probably to be, there's a gravitational back reaction will already cause it to be sufficiently far away so that you can form a black hole. I don't think, but this is just a rough.
You could make a quantitative prediction, right? Because you could bound the entropy
the perturbations. Well, there'd be an entropy bound on what would cause it to collapse. Then you could figure out how much information you could put in a message. Yeah. Still the shared entropy.
I'd be happy to see it.
We should do this calculation.
All right, so I think we should let Paolo do his lecture, and then if you have more questions.
Sorry. So let's go and look again.